This is Audible.
Harper Audio presents Hunger, A Memoir of My Body by Roxane Gay. This is the author. For you, my sunshine, showing me what I no longer need and finding the way to my warm. Part 1. 1. Every body has a story and a history. Here I offer mine with a memoir of my body and my hunger. 2. The story of my body is not a story of triumph. This is not a weight loss memoir. There will be no picture of a thin version of me, my slender body emblazoned across this book's cover, with me standing in one leg of my former, fatter self's jeans. This is not a book that will offer motivation. I don't have any powerful insight into what it takes to overcome an unruly body and unruly appetites. Mine is not a success story. Mine is, simply, a true story. I wish so very much that I could write a book about triumphant weight loss and how I learned to live more effectively with my demons. I wish I could write a book about being at peace and loving myself wholly at any size. Instead, I have written this book, which has been the most difficult writing experience of my life, one far more challenging than I could have ever imagined. When I set out to write Hunger, I was certain the words would come easily the way they usually do. And what could be easier to write about than the body I have lived in for more than 40 years? But I soon realized I was not only writing a memoir of my body. I was forcing myself to look at what my body has endured, the weight I gained, and how hard it has been to both live with and lose that weight. I've been forced to look at my guiltiest secrets. I've cut myself wide open. I am exposed. That is not comfortable. That is not easy. I wish I had the kind of strength and willpower to tell you a triumphant story. I am in search of that kind of strength and willpower. I am determined to be more than my body, what my body has endured, what my body has become. Determination, though, has not gotten me very far. Writing this book is a confession. These are the ugliest, weakest, barest parts of me. This is my truth. This is a memoir of my body because, more often than not, stories of bodies like mine are ignored or dismissed or derided. People see bodies like mine and make their assumptions. They think they know the why of my body. They do not. This is not a story of triumph, but this is a story that demands to be told and deserves to be heard. This is a book about my body, about my hunger, and ultimately, this is a book about disappearing and being lost and wanting so very much, wanting to be seen and understood. This is a book about learning, however slowly, to allow myself to be seen and understood. 3. To tell you the story of my body, do I tell you how much I weighed at my heaviest? Do I tell you that number, the shameful truth of it always strangling me? Do I tell you I know I should not consider the truth of my body shameful? Or do I just tell you the truth while holding my breath and awaiting your judgment? At my heaviest, I weighed 577 pounds at 6'3" tall. That is a staggering number, one I can hardly believe, but at one point that was the truth of my body. I learned of the number at a Cleveland clinic in Weston, Florida. I don't know how I let things get so out of control, but I do. My father went with me to Cleveland Clinic. I was in my late 20s. It was July. Outside, it was hot and muggy and lushly green. In the clinic, the air was frigid and antiseptic. Everything was slick, expensive wood, marble. I thought, this is how I'm spending my summer vacation. There were 7 other people in the meeting room, an orientation session for gastric bypass surgery, 2 fat guys, a slightly overweight woman and her thin husband, 2 people in lab coats, and another large woman. As I surveyed my surroundings, I did that thing fat people tend to do around other fat people. I measured myself in relation to their size. I was bigger than 5, smaller than 2. At least that is what I told myself. For $270, I spent a good portion of my day listening to the benefits of having my anatomy drastically altered to lose weight. It was, the doctor said, the only effective therapy for obesity. They were doctors. They were supposed to know what was best for me. I wanted to believe them. A psychiatrist talked to those of us assembled about how to prepare for the surgery, how to deal with food once our stomachs became the size of a thumb, how to accept that the normal people, his words, not mine, in our lives might try to sabotage our weight loss because they were invested in the idea of us as fat people. We learned how our bodies would be nutrient-deprived for the rest of our lives, how we would never be able to eat or drink within half an hour of doing one or the other. Our hair would thin, maybe fall out. Our bodies could be prone to dumping syndrome, a condition whose name doesn't require a great deal of imagination to decipher. And, of course, there were the surgical risks. We could die on the operating table or succumb to infection in the days following the procedure. It was a good news, bad news scenario. Bad news, our lives and bodies would never be the same, if we even survived the surgery. Good news, we would be thin. We would lose 75% of our excess weight within the first year. We would become next to normal. What those doctors offered was so tempting, so seductive. This notion that we could fall asleep for a few hours, and within a year of waking up, most of our problems would be solved, at least according to the medical establishment. That is, of course, if we continue to delude ourselves that our bodies were our biggest problem. After the presentation, there was a question and answer session. I had neither questions nor answers, but the woman to my right, the woman who clearly did not need to be there because she was no more than 40 or so pounds overweight, dominated the session, asking intimate, personal questions that broke my heart. As she interrogated the doctors, her husband sat next to her, smirking. It became clear why she was there. It was all about him and how he saw her body. There is nothing sadder, I thought, choosing to ignore why I was sitting in that same room, choosing to ignore that there were a great many people in my own life who saw my body before they ever saw or considered me. Later in the day, the doctors showed videos of the surgery. Cameras and surgical tools and slick inner cavities, cutting, pushing, closing, removing essential parts of the human body. The insides were steamy red and pink and yellow. It was grotesque and chilling. My father, on my left, was ashen, clearly shaken by the brutal display. "What do you think?" he asked quietly. "This is a total freak show," I said. He nodded. This was the first thing we had agreed on in years. Then the video ended, and the doctor smiled and chirped that the procedure was brief, done laparoscopically. He assured us he had done over 3,000 operations, lost only one patient, an 850-pound man, he said, his voice dropping to an apologetic whisper, as if the shame of that man's body could not be spoken with the full force of his voice. Then the doctor told us the price of happiness, $25,000, minus a $270 discount for the orientation fee, once a deposit for the procedure was made. Before this torment was over, there was a one-on-one consultation with the doctor in a private examination room. Before the doctor entered, his assistant, an intern, took down my vital information. I was weighed, measured, quietly judged. The intern listened to my heartbeat, felt my throat glands, made some additional notes. The doctor finally breathed in after half an hour. He looked me up and down. He glanced at my new chart, quickly flipping through the pages. "Yes, yes," he said. "You're a perfect candidate for the surgery. We'll get you booked right away." Then he was gone. The intern wrote me prescriptions for the preliminary tests I would need, and I left with a letter verifying that I'd completed the orientation session. It was clear that they did this every day. I was not unique. I was not special. I was a body, one requiring repair, and there are many of us in this world living in such utterly human bodies. My father, who had been waiting in the well-appointed atrium, put a hand on my shoulder. "You're not at this point yet," he said. "A little more self-control. Exercising twice a day, that's all you need." I agreed, nodding vigorously, but later, alone in my bedroom, I pored over the pamphlets I had received, unable to look away from the before-after pictures. I still want that after so badly. And I remembered the result of being weighed and measured and judged, the unfathomable number, 577 pounds. I thought I had known shame in my life, but that night I truly knew shame. I did not know if I would ever find my way past that shame and toward a place where I could face my body, accept my body, change my body. 4. This book, Hunger, is a book about living in the world when you are not a few or even 40 pounds overweight. This is a book about living in the world when you are 300 or 400 pounds overweight, when you are not obese or morbidly obese, but super morbidly obese, according to your body mass index, or BMI. BMI is a term that sounds so technical and inhumane that I am always eager to disregard the measure. Nonetheless, it is a term and a measure that allows the medical establishment to try and bring a sense of discipline to undisciplined bodies. One's BMI is one's weight, in kilograms, divided by the square of one's height in meters. Math is hard. There are various markers that then define the amount of unruliness a human body might carry. If your BMI is between 18.5 and 24.9, you are normal. If your BMI is 25 or higher, you are overweight. If your BMI is 30 or higher, you are obese. And if your BMI is higher than 40, you are morbidly obese. And if the measure is higher than 50, you are super morbidly obese. My BMI is higher than 50. In truth, many medical designations are arbitrary. It is worth noting that in 1998, medical professionals, under the direction of the National Heart, Lung, and Blood Institute, lowered the BMI threshold for normal bodies to below 25, and in doing so, doubled the number of obese Americans. One of their reasons for lowering the cutoff, a round number like 25 would be easy for people to remember. These terms themselves are somewhat horrifying. Obese is an unpleasant word from the Latin obesus, meaning having eaten until fat, which is, in a literal sense, fair enough. But when people use the word obese, they aren't merely being literal. They are offering forth an accusation. It is strange and perhaps sad that medical doctors came up with this terminology when they are charged with first doing no harm. The modifier morbidly makes the fat body a death sentence when such is not the case. The term morbid obesity frames fat people like we are the walking dead, and the medical establishment treats us accordingly. The cultural measure for obesity often seems to be anyone who appears to be larger than a size 6, or anyone whose body doesn't naturally cater to the male gaze, or anyone with cellulite on her thighs. I do not weigh 577 pounds now. I am still very fat, but I weigh about 150 pounds less than that. With every new diet attempt, I shave off a few pounds here, a few pounds there. This is all relative. I am not small. I will never be small. For one, I am tall. That is both a curse and a saving grace. I have presence, I am told. I take up space. I intimidate. I do not want to take up space. I want to go unnoticed. I want to hide. I want to disappear until I gain control of my body. I don't know how things got so out of control, or I do. This is my refrain. Losing control of my body was a matter of accretion. I began eating to change my body. I was willful in this. Some boys had destroyed me, and I barely survived it. I knew I wouldn't be able to endure another such violation, and so I ate because I thought that if my body became repulsive, I could keep men away. Even at that young age, I understood that to be fat was to be undesirable to men, to be beneath their contempt, and I already knew too much about their contempt. This is what most girls are taught, that we should be slender and small. We should not take up space. We should be seen and not heard, and if we are seen, we should be pleasing to men, acceptable to society. And most women know this, that we are supposed to disappear. But it's something that needs to be said loudly, over and over again, so that we can resist surrendering to what is expected of us. 5. What you need to know is that my life is split in two, cleaved not so neatly. There is the before and the after. Before I gained weight, after I gained weight. Before I was raped, after I was raped. 6. In the before of my life, I was so very young and sheltered. I knew nothing about anything. I didn't know I could suffer or the breadth and scope of what suffering could be. I didn't know that I could give voice to my suffering when I did suffer. I didn't know there were better ways to deal with my suffering. Of all the things I wish I knew then that I know now, I wish I had known I could talk to my parents and get help and turn to something other than food. I wish I had known that my violation was not my fault. What I did know was food, so I ate because I understood that I could take up more space. I could become more solid, stronger, safer. I understood, from the way I saw people stare at fat people, from the way I stared at fat people, that too much weight was undesirable. If I was undesirable, I could keep more hurt away. At least, I hoped I could keep more hurt away, because in the after, I knew too much about hurt. I knew too much about hurt, but I didn't know how much a girl could suffer until I did. But this is what I did. This is the body I made. I am corpulent. Rolls of brown flesh, arms and thighs and belly. The fat eventually had nowhere to go, so it created its own paths around my body. I am riven with stretch marks, pockets of cellulite on my massive thighs. The fat created a new body, one that shamed me, but one that made me feel safe, and more than anything, I desperately needed to feel safe. I needed to feel like a fortress, impermeable. I did not want anything or anyone to touch me. I did this to myself. This is my fault and responsibility. This is what I tell myself, though I should not bear the responsibility for this body alone. 7. This is the reality of living in my body. I am trapped in a cage. The frustrating thing about cages is that you're trapped, but you can see exactly what you want. You can reach out from the cage, but only so far. It would be easy to pretend I am just fine with my body as it is. I wish I did not see my body as something for which I should apologize or provide explanation. I'm a feminist, and I believe in doing away with the rigid beauty standards that force women to conform to unrealistic ideals. I believe we should have broader definitions of beauty that include diverse body types. I believe it is so important for women to feel comfortable in their bodies without wanting to change every single thing about their bodies to find that comfort. I want to believe my worth as a human being does not reside in my size or appearance. I know, having grown up in a culture that is generally toxic to women and constantly trying to discipline women's bodies, that it is important to resist unreasonable standards for how my body or any body should look. What I know and what I feel are two very different things. Feeling comfortable in my body isn't entirely about beauty standards. It is not entirely about ideals. It's about how I feel in my skin and bones from one day to the next. I am not comfortable in my body. Nearly everything physical is difficult. When I move around, I feel every extra pound I am carrying. I have no stamina. When I walk for long periods of time, my thighs and calves ache. My feet ache. My lower back aches. More often than not, I am in some kind of physical pain. Every morning I am so stiff, I contemplate just spending the duration of the day in bed. I have a pinched nerve, and so if I stand for too long, my right leg goes numb, and then I sort of lurch about until the feeling returns. When it's hot, I sweat profusely, mostly from my head, and then I feel self-conscious and find myself constantly wiping the sweat from my face. Rivulets of sweat spring forth between my breasts and pool at the base of my spine. My shirt gets damp, and sweat stains begin seeping through the fabric. I feel like people are staring at me, sweating and judging me for having an unruly body that perspires so wantonly, that dares to reveal the costs of its exertion. There are things I want to do with my body, but cannot. If I am with my friends, I cannot keep up, So I am constantly thinking up excuses to explain why I am walking slower than they are, as if they don't already know. Sometimes they pretend not to know, and sometimes it seems like they are genuinely that oblivious to how different bodies move and take up space as they look back at me and suggest we do impossible things like go to an amusement park or walk a mile up a hill to a stadium or go hiking to an overlook with a great view. My body is a cage. My body is a cage of my own making. I am still trying to figure my way out of it. I have been trying to figure a way out of it for more than 20 years. 8. In writing about my body, maybe I should study this flesh, the abundance of it, as a crime scene. I should examine this corporeal effect to determine the cause. I don't want to think of my body as a crime scene. I don't want to think of my body as something gone horribly wrong, something that should be cordoned off and investigated. Is my body a crime scene when I already know I am the perpetrator, or at least one of the perpetrators? Or should I see myself as the victim of the crime that took place in my body? I am marked in so many ways by what I went through. I survived it, but that isn't the whole of the story. Over the years, I have learned the importance of survival and claiming the label of survivor, but I don't mind the label victim. I also don't think there's any shame in saying that when I was raped, I became a victim, and to this day, while I am also many other things, I am still a victim. It took me a long time, but I prefer victim to survivor now. I don't want to diminish the gravity of what happened. I don't want to pretend I'm on some triumphant, uplifting journey. I don't want to pretend that everything is okay. I'm living with what happened, moving forward without forgetting, moving forward without pretending I am unscarred. This is the memoir of my body. My body was broken. I was broken. I did not know how to put myself back together. I was splintered. A part of me was dead. A part of me was mute and would stay that way for many years. I was hollowed out. I was determined to fill the void, and food was what I used to build a shield around what little was left of me. I ate and ate and ate in the hopes that if I made myself big, my body would be safe. I buried the girl I had been because she ran into all kinds of trouble. I tried to erase every memory of her, but she is still there, somewhere. She is still small and scared and ashamed, and perhaps I am writing my way back to her, trying to tell her everything she needs to hear. 9. I was broken, and to numb the pain of that brokenness, I ate and ate and ate, and then I was not just overweight or fat. Less than a decade later, I was morbidly obese, and then I was super morbidly obese. I was trapped in my body, one I made but barely recognized or understood. I was miserable, but I was safe, or at least I could tell myself I was safe. My memories of the after are scattered, fragmentary, but I do clearly remember eating and eating and eating so I could forget, so my body could become so big it would never be broken again. I remember the quiet comfort of eating when I was lonely or sad or even happy. Today, I am a fat woman. I don't think I'm ugly. I don't hate myself in the way society would have me hate myself. But I do live in the world. I live in this body, in this world. And I hate how the world all too often responds to this body. Intellectually, I recognize that I am not the problem. This world and its unwillingness to accept and accommodate me are the problem. But I suspect it is more likely that I can change before this culture and its attitudes toward fat people will change. In addition to fighting the good fight about body positivity, I also need to think about the quality of my life in the here and now. I have been living in this unruly body for more than 20 years. I have tried to make peace with this body. I have tried to love or at least tolerate this body in a world that displays nothing but contempt for it. I have tried to move on from the trauma that compelled me to create this body. I have tried to love and be loved. I have been silent about my story in a world where people assume they know the why of my body or any fat body. And now, I am choosing to no longer be silent. I am tracing the story of my body from when I was a carefree young girl who could trust her body and who felt safe in her body, to the moment when that safety was destroyed, to the aftermath that continues, even as I try to undo so much of what was done to me. Part 2. 10. There is a picture of me. My older cousin is holding me the weekend of my christening. I am still an infant, wearing a long white satin gown. We are sitting on a plastic-covered couch in New York City. In the picture, my cousin is older, maybe 5 or 6. I am squirming with senseless baby rage, my limbs at awkward angles. I am grateful that there are so many pictures of me from my childhood, because there is so much I have forgotten in one way or another. There are years and years of my life I can't remember a thing about. A family member will say, "Remember the time?" Insert significant family moment. And I stare blankly with no recollection of these moments whatsoever. We have a shared history, and yet we do not. In many ways, that's the best means of describing my relationship with my family and with nearly everyone in my life. There is the great life we share and the more difficult parts of my life we do not, that they know little about. There is no rhyme or reason to what I can and cannot remember. It's also hard to explain this absence of memory because there are moments from my childhood I remember like they were yesterday. I have a good memory. I can remember conversations with friends almost word for word, even years after they occur. I remember how platinum blonde the hair of my 4th grade teacher was, or how I got in trouble for reading in class in the 3rd grade because I was bored. I remember my aunt and uncle's wedding in Port-au-Prince, and how my knees swelled like an orange after I was bitten by a mosquito. I remember good things. I remember bad things. When I have to, though, I can strip my memory bare, and I have done this at times when erasure was necessary. I have photo albums taken from my parents' house, albums swollen with fading pictures of my 2 brothers and me when we were very young. This was before the digital age, and still, it seemed like almost every moment of my life was photographed, and then each picture was developed and meticulously archived. Each album has a big number on it, with a circle around that number. In many of the albums, there are brief notes with names, ages, places. It's as if my mother knew these memories needed to be preserved for a reason. She raised my brothers and me with iron will and her own kind of grace. The fierceness of her love for and devotion to us is overwhelming, and this fierceness only grows stronger the older we get. When I was a child, my mother kept these albums in a neat sequential row, and when one album was filled, she went and bought another album and filled it too. My mother has tried to fill in some of the blanks from my childhood, even if she doesn't realize she's doing it. She remembers everything, or that's how it seems, or that's how it was until I went away to boarding school at 13, and then there was no one to hold on to my memories for me. My mom still takes pictures of everything and has more than 20,000 pictures on her Flickr stream, pictures of her life and our lives and the people and places in our lives. At my doctoral defense, there she was, staring at me so proudly, every few minutes picking up her camera to snap a new picture, to capture every possible second of my moment. At a reading for my novel in New York City, there she was again with her camera, taking pictures, documenting another memorable moment. People often notice that I take pictures of every little thing. I say I do it so I won't forget, so I cannot forget all the amazing things I see and experience. I don't explain that memories matter more to me now that my life looks different, but it's more than that. The ways in which I am my mother's daughter are infinite. The cover of my baby album is white with specks of glitter throughout. It's a girl is emblazoned across the cover. On the first page of this album are my parents' names, my date of birth, my height and weight, hair and eye color. There are 2 black imprints of my baby feet with the words, "Girl Gay," written above them. I was born at 7:48 in the morning, which is why, I am certain, I am not a morning person. There are blank lines for exciting memories in baby's life, and all of those lines have been filled with my first tiny accomplishments. Apparently, I read the alphabet at 2.5 years old and could tell time at 3. My mother proudly wrote, "Reads almost everything at 5 years old." Those are her exact words, written in her neat penmanship, though family lore has me reading the newspaper with my dad about a year and a half before that. For the first 5 years of my life, my mother recorded my height and weight. I had a big head that was triangular, something that can happen with the firstborn child. My mother says she spent hours smoothing my newborn head into a rounder shape. There was a record of my birth in the Omaha World Herald, printed on October 28, 1974, 13 days after my birthday, and the clipped section of the newspaper is stored in this album, alongside my original birth certificate and the little card they put on my bassinet in the hospital. My mother was 25 and my father was 27, so young, but given the era, not as young as many people were when they started families. My name is spelled correctly on my birth certificate with one N, and the birth certificate is pink. A nuanced cultural understanding of gender did not exist then. Girls were pink and boys were blue, and that was that. In the very first picture of my mother and me together, she is holding me, and her jet black hair is cascading down her back in a thick ponytail. She looks impossibly young and beautiful. I am 3 days old. This is actually not the first picture of us together. There is a picture of my mom, hugely pregnant with me, wearing a sassy blue mini dress and a pair of chunky heels. Her hair is wild and hanging loose down her back. She is leaning against the car, giving a look to the photographer, my father, the kind of intimate look that makes me want to turn away to afford them some privacy. She put this picture in the album, even though she is one of the most private people I know. She wanted me to see this gorgeous image, to know she and my father have always loved each other. These oldest pictures have been in the album so long that they are stuck to the pages. To try and remove the pictures would ruin them. Every picture of me as an infant with my parents reveals them smiling at me like I am the center of their world. I was. I am. This is part of my truth I know with real clarity. Everything good and strong about me starts with my parents. Absolutely everything. Almost every picture of me as an infant shows me smiling a smile so infectious that when I look at them, I cannot help but smile too. There are happy babies, and there are happy babies. I was a happy baby. This is indisputable. Babies are cute, but they're pretty useless, my best friend says. They can't do much for themselves. You have to love them through that uselessness. In the pictures where I'm alone, I am being propped up by the arm of a chair or a few pillows. In one picture, on a hideous, thickly brocaded red couch, I am alone and visibly screaming my head off. There is more than one picture of me screaming my head off. Pictures of screaming babies are hilarious when you know they are pictures of happy babies who are simply having a random fit of baby rage. I look at these baby pictures and think, I look like my niece. But really, it is my young niece who looks like me. Family is powerful, no matter what. We're always tied together with our eyes and our lips and our blood and our bloody hearts. When I was 3, my brother Joel was born. There are pictures of him, brown and round, a full head of hair, sitting or standing next to me. As an adult, I have gone through these albums many times. I have been trying to remember. At first, I looked for pictures to show a child of my own. This is where you come from, so when I have that child, she might know her family knows how to love, however imperfectly. So she knows her mother has always been loved, and so she may know that she, in turn, will always be loved. It is important to show a child love in many forms, and this is the one good thing I have to offer, no matter how this child comes into my life. I also study the pictures, the people in them. I recall the names and places, the moments that matter, so many of which elude me. I try to piece together the memories I have so carefully erased. I try to make sense of how I went from the child in these perfect photograph moments to who I am today. I know, precisely, and yet I do not know. I know, but I think what I really want is to understand the why of the distance between then and now. The why is complicated and slippery. I want to be able to hold the why in my hands, to dissect it or tear it apart or burn it and read the ashes, even though I am afraid of what I will do with what I see there. I don't know if such understanding is possible, but when I am alone, I sit and slowly page through these albums obsessively. I want to see what is there, and what is missing, and what happened, even if the why still eludes me. There is a picture of me. I am 5. I have big eyes and a scrawny neck. I am staring at a plastic typewriter while I lie on a couch, on my stomach, ankles crossed, probably daydreaming. I always daydreamed. Even then, I was a writer. From an early age, I would draw little villages on napkins and write stories about the people who lived in those villages. I loved the escape of writing those stories, of imagining lives that were different from my own. I had a ferocious imagination. I was a daydreamer, and I resented being pulled out of my daydreams to deal with the business of living. In my stories, I could write myself the friends I did not have. I could make so many things possible that I did not dare imagine for myself. I could be brave. I could be smart. I could be funny. I could be everything I ever wanted. When I wrote, it was so easy to be happy. There is a picture of me. I am 7. I am happy, wearing overalls. I wore overalls a lot as a kid. I liked them for a lot of reasons, but mostly I liked them because they had many pockets where I could hide things, and because they were complicated and had lots of buttons and things requiring fastening. They made me feel safe, cozy. In probably 1 out of every 3 or 4 pictures from that period, I am wearing overalls. That's strange, but I was strange. In this particular picture, I am with my brother Joel, and he is karate kicking me as I try to avoid his little foot. He was and is very energetic. We are 3 years apart. We are having fun. We are still very close. We were cute kids. It kills me to see that kind of naked joy in myself. I would give almost anything to be that free again. When I was 8, my brother Michael Jr. was born, and then there were 3 of us in all of the pictures, often huddled together or holding hands as we stared into the camera. As much as I wrote, I lost myself in books even more. I read everything I could get my hands on. My favorite books were the Little House on the Prairie books. I loved the idea that Laura Ingalls, an ordinary girl from the plains, could live an ordinary, extraordinary life in a time so different from mine. I loved all the details in the books. Pa bringing home delectable oranges, making candy in the snow with maple syrup, the bond shared by the Ingalls sisters, Laura being called Half Pint. As the Ingalls girls grew up, I loved Laura's rivalry with Nellie Olson and her courtship with Almanza Wilder, who would eventually become her husband. I was breathless when I read about the first years of their marriage as homesteaders, enduring the trials of farming and raising their daughter Rose. I wanted that kind of steady, true love for myself, and I wanted a relationship where I could be independent, but loved and looked after at the same time. When I moved on from Little House on the Prairie, I read everything by Judy Blume. I mostly learned about sex from her novel Forever. And for many years, I assumed that all men called their dicks Ralph. I read books about adventurous girls mining for gold in California and surviving the trials and tribulations of the wagon trail. I became intensely obsessed with the loving rivalry of Jessica and Elizabeth Wakefield in the idyllic California town of Sweet Valley. I read Clan of the Cave Bear and learned that sex could be far more interesting than the youthful fumblings of Catherine and Michael in Forever had indicated. I read and read and read. My imagination expanded infinitely. There are countless pictures of me wearing skirts and dresses, pictures where I am a girly girl with long, done-up hair, jewelry doing the whole pretty princess thing. I long thought I was a tomboy because I was the only girl in my family. Sometimes we try to convince ourselves of things that are not true, reframing the past to better explain the present. When I look at these pictures, it is quite clear that while I enjoyed roughhousing and playing in dirt with my brothers and such, I wasn't entirely a tomboy, not really. I played with G.I. Joe action figures and built forts in the empty lot next to our home and caroused in the woods on the edge of our neighborhood because my brothers were my playmates. Most of the time, my brothers were my best friends besides the ones I found in books. The 3 of us got along well, except when we bickered, and oh, we could bicker, particularly my brother Joel and me. We bickered about everything and nothing, and then we made up and made trouble. The baby, Michael Jr., was so much younger that he was generally a willing accomplice to our shenanigans. When he wasn't our accomplice, he was the target of petty cruelties, like when we sent him down the basement stairs in a laundry basket, or tormented him with a plastic spider, or worst of all, ignored his plaintive desire to play with us. Somehow, through it all, he adored us, and Joel and I basked in the glow of his adoration. These pictures from the photo albums of my childhood are artifacts of a time when I was happy and whole. They are evidence that once I was pretty and sometimes sweet. Beneath what you see now, there is still a pretty girl who loves pretty girl things. In these pictures, I get older. I smile less. I am still pretty. When I am 12, I stop wearing skirts or most jewelry or doing anything with my hair, instead wearing it back in a tight bun or ponytail. I am still pretty. A few years after that, I will cut most of my hair off and start wearing oversized men's clothing. I am less pretty. In these pictures, I stare at the camera. I look hollow. I am hollow. 11. I don't know how to talk about rape and sexual violence when it comes to my own story. It is easier to say, something terrible happened. Something terrible happened. That something terrible broke me. I wish I could leave it at that, but this is a memoir of my body, so I need to tell you what happened to my body. I was young, and I took my body for granted. And then I learned about the terrible things that could happen to a girl body, and everything changed. Something terrible happened. And I wish I could leave it at that, because as a writer who is also a woman, I don't want to be defined by the worst thing that has happened to me. I don't want my personality to be consumed in that way. I don't want my work to be consumed or defined by this terrible something. At the same time, I don't want to be silent. I can't be silent. I don't want to pretend nothing terrible has ever happened to me. I don't want to carry all the secrets I carried alone for too many years. I cannot do these things anymore. If I must share my story, I want to do so on my terms, without the attention that inevitably follows. I do not want pity or appreciation or advice. I am not brave or heroic. I am not strong. I am not special. I am one woman who has experienced something countless women have experienced. I am a victim who survived. It could have been worse, so much worse. That's what matters, and is even more a travesty here, that having this kind of story is utterly common. I hope that by sharing my story, by joining a chorus of women and men who share their stories too, more people can become appropriately horrified by how much suffering is born of sexual violence, how far-reaching the repercussions can be. I often write around what happened to me because that is easier than going back to that day, to everything leading up to that day, to what happened after. It's easier than facing myself in the ways, despite everything I know, in which I feel culpable for what happened. Even now, I feel guilt, not only for what happened, but for how I handled the after, for my silence, for my eating, and what became of my body. I write around what happened because I don't want to have to defend myself. I don't want to have to deal with the horror of such exposure. I guess that makes me a coward, afraid, weak, human. I write around what happened because I don't want my family to have these terrible images in their heads. I don't want them to know what I endured and then kept secret for more than 25 years. I don't want my lovers seeing only a moment from my assault when they look at me. I don't want them to think me more fragile than I am. I am stronger than I am broken. I don't want them or anyone to think I am nothing more than the worst thing that has ever happened to me. I want to protect the people I love. I want to protect myself. My story is mine, and on most days I wish I could bury that story somewhere deep where I might be free of it. But it has been 30 years, and inexplicably I am still not free of it. I all too often write around my story, but still, I write. I share parts of my story, and this sharing becomes part of something bigger, a collective testimony of people who have painful stories too. I make that choice. We don't necessarily know how to hear stories about any kind of violence, because it is hard to accept that violence is as simple as it is complicated, that you can love someone who hurts you, that you can stay with someone who hurts you, that you can be hurt by someone who loves you, that you can be hurt by a complete stranger, that you can be hurt in so many terrible, intimate ways. I also share what I do of my story because I believe in the importance of sharing histories of violence. I am reticent to share my own history of violence, but that history informs so much of who I am, what I write, how I write. It informs how I move through the world. It informs how I love and allow myself to be loved. It informs everything. It is easier to use detached language like assault or violation or incident than it is to come out and say that when I was 12 years old, I was gang raped by a boy I thought I loved and a group of his friends. When I was 12 years old, I was raped. So many years past being raped, I tell myself what happened is in the past. This is only partly true. In too many ways, the past is still with me. The past is written on my body. I carry it every single day. The past sometimes feels like it might kill me. It is a very heavy burden. In my history of violence, there was a boy. I loved him. His name was Christopher. That's not really his name. You know that. I was raped by Christopher and several of his friends in an abandoned hunting cabin in the woods where no one but those boys could hear me scream. Before that, though, Christopher and I were friends, or at least shared a semblance of friendship. During school hours, he would ignore me, but after school, we would hang out. We would do whatever he wanted. He was always in control of the time we spent together. In truth, he treated me terribly, and I thought I should be grateful that he bothered to treat me terribly, that he bothered with a girl like me at all. I had no reason to have such low self-esteem at 12 years old. I had no reason to allow myself to be treated terribly. It happened anyway. That gnawing truth is a lot of what I still struggle to free myself from. This boy and I were riding bikes in the woods when we stopped at the cabin, this disgusting, forgotten place where teenagers got up to no good. His friends were waiting, and then we were standing inside the cabin, and Christopher was bragging to them about things he and I had done, private things, and I was so embarrassed because I was a good Catholic girl, and I already felt so very guilty that Christopher and I had done things we should not have done. I was confused because I had no idea why he would tell his friends what I had never told anyone, what I thought was our secret, what made him love me or at least keep me around. His friends were excited by the things Christopher said. They were so very excited, their faces flushed and their laughs raucous. While they talked around me, I felt smaller and smaller. I was scared even if I couldn't recognize the strange energy running through me. I did try to run out of there once I realized I was not safe, but it was no use. I could not save myself. Christopher pushed me down in front of his laughing friends, so many bodies larger than mine. I was so scared and embarrassed and confused. I was hurt because I loved him and thought he loved me. And in a matter of moments, there I was, splayed out in front of his friends. I wasn't a girl to them. I was a thing, flesh and girl bones with which they could amuse themselves. When Christopher lay on top of me, he didn't take off his clothes. This detail stays with me, that he had such little regard for what he was about to do to me. He just unzipped his jeans and knelt between my legs and shoved himself inside of me. Those other boys stared down at me, leered really, and egged Christopher on. I closed my eyes because I did not want to see them. I did not want to accept what was happening. As a sheltered, good Catholic girl, I barely understood what was happening. I did understand the pain, though, the sharpness and the immediacy of it. That pain was inescapable and held me in my body when I wanted to abandon it to those boys and hide myself somewhere safe. I begged Christopher to stop. I told him I would do anything he wanted if he would just make it all stop, but he didn't stop. He didn't look at me. Christopher took a long time, or at least it felt like a long time, because I did not want him inside me. It did not matter what I wanted. After Christopher came, he switched places with the boy who was holding my arms down. I fought, but my fighting didn't do much more than make those boys laugh. The friend held me down, his lips shiny, his beer breath in my face. To this day, I cannot stand beer breath. I thought I would break beneath the weight of those boys. I was already so sore. Christopher refused to look at me. He just held my wrists, spat on my face. I told myself, I still tell myself, he was just trying to impress his friends. I tell myself he didn't mean it. He laughed. All those boys raped me. They tried to see how far they could go. I was a toy, used recklessly. Eventually, I stopped screaming. I stopped moving. I stopped fighting. I stopped praying and believing God would save me. I did not stop hurting. The pain was constant. They took a break. I huddled into myself and shook. I couldn't move. I could not believe what was happening. I literally had no capacity for understanding my story as it was being written. I don't remember their names. Other than Christopher, I don't remember distinct details about them. They were boys who were not yet men but knew already how to do the damage of men. I remember their smells, the squareness of their faces, the weight of their bodies, the tangy smell of their sweat, the surprising strength in their limbs. I remember that they enjoyed themselves and laughed a lot. I remember that they had nothing but disdain for me. They did things I've never been able to talk about and will never be able to talk about. I don't know how. I don't want to find those words. I have a history of violence, but the public record of it will always be incomplete. When it was all over, I pushed my bike home, and I pretended to be the daughter my parents knew, the good girl, the straight-A student. I don't know how I hid what happened, but I knew how to be a good girl, and I guess I played that part exceptionally well that night. Later, those boys told everyone at school what happened, or rather, a version of the story that made my name Slut for the rest of the school year. I immediately understood that my version of the story would never matter, so I kept the truth of what happened a secret and tried to live with this new name. He said, she said, is why so many victims, or survivors if you prefer that terminology, don't come forward. All too often, what he said matters more, so we just swallow the truth. We swallow it, and more often than not, that truth turns rancid. It spreads through the body like an infection. It becomes depression, or addiction, or obsession, or some other physical manifestation of the silence of what she would have said, needed to say, couldn't say. With every day that went by, I hated myself more. I disgusted myself more. I couldn't get away from him. I couldn't get away from what those boys did. I could smell them and feel their mouths and their tongues and their hands and their rough bodies and their cruel skin. I couldn't stop hearing the terrible things they said to me. Their voices were with me constantly. Hating myself became as natural as breathing. Those boys treated me like nothing, so I became nothing. 12. There is a before and an after. In the after, I was broken, shattered, and silent. I was numb. I was terrified. I carried this secret and knew in my soul that what those boys did to me had to stay secret. I couldn't share the shame and humiliation of it. I was disgusting because I had allowed disgusting things to be done to me. I was not a girl. I was less than human. I was no longer a good girl, and I was going to hell. I was 12, and suddenly I was no longer a child. I no longer felt free or happy or safe. I became more and more withdrawn. If I had a saving grace, it was that we moved all the time for my father's job, and the summer after I was raped, we moved to a new state where I could have my name again, and no one knew I was the girl in the woods. I still had no friends, and I did not try to make friends, because how could we possibly have anything in common? I did not dare subject what I had become to the children around me. I read obsessively. When I read on the school bus, my classmates teased me. Sometimes they took my book from me and threw it back and forth as I flailed, helplessly, just trying to get that book back into my hands. When I read, I could forget. I could be anywhere in the world except in the eighth grade, lonely and holding tightly to my secret. I often say that reading and writing saved my life. I mean that quite literally. At home, I tried to be the good girl my parents stopped me to be, but it was exhausting. On so many occasions, I wanted to tell them something was wrong, that I was dying inside, but I couldn't find the words. I couldn't find a way to overcome my fear of what they might say and do and think of me. The longer I stayed silent, the more that fear grew until it dwarfed everything else. I couldn't let my parents see who or what I had become because they would be disgusted and they would discard me like the trash I knew myself to be, and then I would not only be nothing, I would have nothing. There was no room in my life for the truth. I know now that I was wrong, that my parents would have supported me, helped me, and sought justice for me. They would have shown me that the shame was not mine to bear. Unfortunately, my fearful silence cannot be undone. I cannot tell that 12-year-old girl who was so scared and alone just how much she was loved, how unconditionally, but oh, how I want to, how I want to comfort her, how I want to save her from so much of what would happen next. I played the part of good girl, good daughter, good student. I went to church even though I had no faith. Guilt consumed me. I no longer believed in God because surely, if there were a God, he would have saved me from Christopher and those boys in the woods. I no longer believed in God because I had sinned. I had sinned in a way I hadn't even known was possible until I learned what was possible. It was lonely and terrifying to be unmoored from everything that had been so important in my life. My family, my faith, myself. I was alone with my secret, pretending to be a different kind of girl. To survive, I tried to forget what had happened. Those boys, the stink of their breath, their hands taking my body from me, killing me from the inside out. 13. Before this terrible thing happened, I had already started to lose my body. I was too young, in a sad semblance of a relationship with a boy who knew too much, wanted too much. I wanted too much too, but he and I wanted very different things. Christopher wanted to use me. I wanted him to love me. I wanted him to fill the loneliness, to ease the ache of being awkward, of being the girl always on the outside looking in. When I met him, we had just moved to the area. I had, and have, this void, this cavern of loneliness inside me that I have spent my whole life trying to fill. I was willing to do most anything if that boy would ease my loneliness. I wanted to feel like he and I belonged to each other, but each time we were together, and then after, I felt quite the opposite. And still, I was drawn to him. At the time, I was, and would continue to be for many years, obsessed with the Sweet Valley High books. I read them voraciously because I was nothing like Elizabeth and Jessica Wakefield, or even Enid Rollins. I would never date a boy like Todd Wilkins, the handsome captain of the basketball team, or Bruce Patman, the handsome, wealthy bad boy of Sweet Valley. When I read the books, though, I could pretend that a better life was possible for me, one where I fit in somewhere, anywhere, and I had friends and a handsome boyfriend and a loving family who knew everything about me. In a better life, I could pretend I was a good girl. This boy, Christopher, so handsome and so popular, was my piece of Sweet Valley High in my well-manicured suburban neighborhood. Certainly, no one could know this because he never acknowledged me at school, but I knew, and I told myself that was enough. For many, many years to come, I would keep telling myself that the barest minimum of acknowledgement from lovers was enough. We would hang out in his bedroom and flip through worn copies of his older brother's Playboy and Hustler magazines. I studied these naked women, mostly young, white, blonde, thin, taut. Their bodies seemed alien.